glorification of perfect matchings.
Okay, thank you, and sorry for not being more prepared when we started. Okay, so I'm going to talk about a joint project with Ilka Chinakshi and Matt Presland, which has really finally come to fruition. We even submitted version 2 to the archive last month from here. So that was a major achievement. Anyway, so what do I mean by categorification in this context? I mean a slightly more nebulous activity of explaining kind of combinatorics by representation theory. And in this context, the obvious example of this is replacing cluster algebras, which I regard essentially, well, which have a strong combinatorial flavor by cluster categories. And the thing I definitely don't mean is what is sometimes also called categorification, which is this sort of higher representation theory of Kovanov and Ruke and people like that, which is a much more delicate thing. For this talk, what I mean is when we know combinatorially a lot about diamond models and perfect matchings, and I want to try and convince you that these things are really objects in algebra, namely quivers with faces. Okay, well, that's fairly combinatorial as well as algebraic. But more importantly, their representations of perfect matchings I'm replacing by representations of some sort of quivers. Okay, and the context in which I'm going to explain this is limited, but in some sense, the technology, I think we already have reasons to believe the technology is rather more general. So the context is diamond models on a disk. These sort of pictures are very well known from describing the combinatorics of the positroid stratification of the Grassmannian. This, I think, would be G37. You can see the 7, but you can't see the 3 yet. And so this is, we have a planar bipartite graph, but it satisfies some consistency condition on the strands, which are sort of zigzag paths on this graph. So the strands, as they're drawn, kind of are off the graph, but really represent their path that goes from 5 here, 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 here. Oops, did I get it? Here, here. From 5 to 7. So you can think of that as a path on the graph or just a strand in a Poznikov diagram. And dual to this, this isn't a revolutionary observation really, but dual to this, there is a quiver with faces. Faces are oriented cycles in the quiver. The faces are dual to the nodes of the graph, and whether they're black and white tells you what the orientation should be. But the quiver is canonically an oriented thing. So once we've written down the quiver, we don't have to have a convention for what black and white means. The quiver is the quiver. The arrows in the quiver go in one particular direction. That has meaning in representation theory. And so we have a problem we can worry about. I mean, a quiver is represented by, in general, in the simplest cases, by vector spaces and linear maps, which go in the direction of the arrows between the vector spaces. Okay. But this data of the faces is a crucial additional ingredient, which makes this a diamond model in some sense. Okay. So what's the particular combinatorics I want to try to explain? Well, there's this famous sort of labeling rule. Strictly speaking, there are 4 labeling rules, but I'm going to do one of them, and hopefully you can see why, which is we look at this strand diagram. We look at, say, the strand that goes from 1 to 5, and we put a 1 in every alternating region on the left of that, and then we do that for all the strands, and we discover, well, at first sight miraculously, but not really, that all the alternating regions end up with the same number of labels. In this case, that number is 3. So that was why it was G37. So the labels I will write in this notation, they are K subsets of the set of labels of the boundary, which really means the boundary arrows in some sense, here of the a quiver, i.e. the boundary legs of the bipartite graph. And what is K? Well, the cute way of saying K, I think, the most cute way that I know Matthew likes to say, and I think he's right, is that it's the average increment of the strand permutation of the diagram. So the strand permutation is the thing which tells you where the labels go. So here's a 2, 4, 6 cycle, and then the other one is a also a 1-5-3-7-3 cycle. And the increments of those, well, 2 to 4 is 2, 4 to 6 is 2, 6 to 2 is 3, going clockwise around the boundary. So the average of these is 3. Okay. Oh, that's not very good. Sorry, I don't know how to get rid of. Where would you like me to drag it? Keep moving, Richard. I don't think I can move any further. Oh, can I drag it off the bottom? Okay, well, that'll be fun. Okay, and so the way you see this really is to think about the necklace. So so it's clear that the labels of the boundary vertices of this quiver only depend on the permutation. Because the permutation takes me from 2 to 4, the boundary labels had 2s just here. In this case, I guess 2 didn't appear anywhere else anyway, but the boundary labels are just determined by the permutation. So this thing called the necklace is a function of the permutation, and it's clear then that the size of the boundary labels, the necklace labels, are this average. And if you cross a crossing, the number doesn't change. So that's why it's the same. But this is as much as anything to draw your attention to this necklace. In principle, there are other labeling conventions, and there's at least one more necklace, which is a reasonable thing to do. I won't be drawn as to which of the two possible necklaces this is, but it's this one. Okay. Is it working? Okay, where am I? Good. Okay, so what was this combinatorics supposed to do? It was supposed to tell us something about the positroid strata in the positive or strictly non-negative Grassmannian. So the Grassmannian is something that parameterizes k-dimensional subspaces really by, say, thinking of them as coming from the SLK invariants of k by n matrices. And this coordinate ring is generated by the minors of the matrix. They satisfy some Plucker relations, which I don't care about here. And then the real Grassmannian is defined to be those basically real matrices for which all the minors are non-negative. And the magic thing is that this is a disjoint union of some strata called positroid strata. And you can find out which positroid your matrix is in by looking precisely at which minors are positive. This is a stratification of the positive Grassmannian. And it's a very interesting question to ask, well, what are all the possible positroids? In the normal Grassmannian context, a similar question would be answered by matroids, and that's much more complicated. So positroids are very pretty and somehow simpler. This stratification is much simpler and nicer than the matroid stratification. Okay. More. Oh, yeah. Brilliant. Oh, pick one. Pick where one. Okay, very good. So where were we? Okay, so in this language, you can even say what a cluster is without having to say what a cluster algebra is, which is, and in some sense, I guess this is sort of motivating for the development of the subject, that a cluster is a subset of this positroid such that the stratum is parameterized by simply the those minors. So this is a sort of chart. So it's a set of minors. Of course, they have to be in the positroid, they have to be positive, such that they actually parameterize the cluster. And Poznikov's original kind of motivation for developing this, his original result, was that these clusters can be written down as the left source labels of these labels, the sum diamond model on a disk with strand permutation pi. And of course, this already tells you something, that these positroids are parameterized by the permutation. They really only depend on the permutation by the necklace. And in some sense, the necklace is minimal in the positroid. So we'll see what this means algebraically later. But then the nice fact, which I think took a little while to sort of digest and it, from out of the way he actually described them, is that this positroid is the set of boundary values of perfect matchings for any diamond model with this same strand permutation pi. And just, I mean, this came up in Karen's talk, but just to remind you that if the strand permutation is uniform, i.e. the uniform permutation with average increment k, constant increment k, then the positroid is the whole thing. But there are lots more interesting cases. Okay, so now I'm trying to sell the fact that we should think about a quiver with faces rather than a bipartite graph. So this is a perfect matching on a bipartite graph. Every vertex is contained in one matched edge. I don't care about the boundary vertices. In fact, I haven't drawn them as vertices because they're not really vertices anyway. These are sort of half edges, really. So every actual vertex or node of the graph is contained in one matched edge, which when we say it dually means a matching is a collection of arrows on the quiver, such that every face contains one arrow. And now in this version, I don't really have to fuss about boundary, tell you how to think about boundary arrows. They're arrows just as well. The other arrow. But they are in one face and not in two faces. It's any different. Okay, so that's a perfect matching. What's the boundary value of a perfect matching? Well, it's the restriction of the matching to the string of digons you can make by essentially using the boundary arrows and then adding an arrow in the opposite direction, which represents the path the other way on the face that it's in. Because it's a boundary arrow, it's in one face, so there's a unique path back the other way. And so for here, for example, I've drawn this so that all the clockwise arrows kind of go one way and all the anti-clockwise arrows go the other way. This doesn't have an interior, so there's no sense in which one of these is outside and one of these is inside. But you've got to be just a little bit careful. This matched one is this arrow here, and this clockwise one is that face, is the other side of that face, which is unmatched. Now, clearly, because there's only one arrow in each complete face, there's precisely one of these two arrows, one of these.
What is a face? It's one of the regions.
One of the cycles in the quiver. Okay. With faces. I mean, when you draw something in the plane, you can see them. But it's part of the data of a quiver with faces. Yeah. Sorry, say that again. Yes. So the question is why are there a different number of arrows in these two pictures? Well, the point is, this arrow here actually represented this path. They can't see the pointer. Oh, well, that's a complete disaster. Okay, so the arrow that you can't see I'm pointing at, that goes anti-clockwise at 6, is matched because the anti-clockwise path on the boundary face at 6 has a matched arrow. So the fact there's a different number means some arrow must be. Right, very good. No, there. Yeah, so this quiver, which I can't point at anymore.
There's a suggestion in the chat that you could use the mouse on your computer to point if you'd like.
You see that?
Yes.
Okay, maybe I'll do that. So what was the question? Yes. I've forgotten what the question is. Yes, so I mean, as Matthew said, this arrow here that points to this vertex contributes an arrow to both of the faces. It contributes both this anti-clockwise arrow and this clockwise arrow. In the way the 14 arrows on the right are related to the arrows on the left. Is that clearer? Yeah, sure. Okay. So this is an example of a perfect matching on this quiver whose boundary value is actually 237. It's not 125, it's 237. And you can see that I'm not going to tell you, and it's not maybe not immediately clear, but the number of boundary labels here is the same k that we had before. But what is it in this particular case? What is it clearly and explicitly in this case? It is the number of clockwise faces in the quiver minus the number of anti-clockwise faces plus the number of anti-clockwise boundary arrows. So that's clearly a constant of this, and it's clearly the number of boundary labels that we will get. Why it's the same k, I mean, I leave that as an exercise for those who are interested. Okay, so how far have I got? Just about halfway. So now I've got to categorify this. So I'm going to tell you three algebras which are relevant to saying how to categorify this story about perfect matchings, and then I'm going to tell you how to categorify the perfect matching. So the first one of them is somehow the circle algebra, which we've pretty much seen now, which is associated to the boundary circle, where we have these two sets of arrows. It's the complete path algebra of this circle of n digons, and it has two relations, one xy equals yx, however you interpret that. And it has a relation somehow from the k that, I mean, it's less obvious, but it says x, y to the k is x to the n minus k in this convention. And then this is a very nice algebra. It has a center, which is just power series ring in one variable. And this is the variable that essentially acts by x, y from every vertex. And because x, y equals y, x, then it doesn't even matter which order that's in. So that's why it's central. And this is a nice algebra over Z. It's a Z order. It's free and finitely generated in particular as an algebra over Z. And then associated to this is the category of Kerr-Macaulay modules, which are C modules, which are free and finitely generated over Z. And this is a very nice category. It's what people will call a Frobenius Coster category. In particular, it's stably Tupolev-Yau. So X1 in this category is symmetric. And then the point about the relation. Well, so the relation is required somehow to make this algebra smaller than what you might think. You might think you're looking at the pre-projective algebra of type A n tilde, but you're looking at some quotient of that. And in particular, the rank one modules which are just the center Z, i.e. a free Z module of rank one at every vertex, and have the arrows acting as either 1t or t1, and then this label set tells you which ones act as T and which ones act as one. This defines a rank one module, I'm calling here MJ, for this quiver. And one of the slightly non-obvious things, but again, amusing exercise, is to see that, again, it's sort of the same. We want the relation with the K in it so that all these labels are the K element subsets. If you took the same definition for a different K, you wouldn't get modules for this algebra. You get modules for an algebra with a different relation on it. Ignoring that part, these are sort of rank one matrix factorizations of T on each digon, if you know what that means. If that's not helpful, then just ignore it. Perhaps the one other thing to mention is that the K here is really coming from how we chose to label the modules, and it was using the same convention that we labeled the boundary matchings when we did them on the previous slide. So here, whatever it is I decide to call this, to say there are three clockwise arrows rather than four anti-clockwise arrows. It's the same convention here. But really, the invariant of this module is the actual boundary matching itself. That's canonical, and this rule is this of this module is a canonical function of that matching. Okay, so whether this is MJ or MJ complement is a matter of labeling, but okay. And then this is sort of one of my joint work with Ben Jensen and Chuping Su. I mean, one of the things we did is we showed that there is a cluster character on this category with values in the Grassmannian coordinate ring, and which sends these MJs to the Plucker coordinates delta J. And to be fair, this was just a small kind of tweak of what Geissler Clerk-Schurer had already done, but sort of something that restores the natural cyclic symmetry of the situation. Okay, and then the second thing we need is to do something on the disk. And for that, so that's joint work with Aaron Marsh, which kind of followed, or well, even pretty much paralleled this, where we realized that if we define we can define an algebra called the dimer algebra associated to the disk. It's the complete path algebra now modulo relations that say whenever two faces share an arrow, the two kind of return paths are equal in that face. If you know what a frozen Jacobi algebra is, you can say the faces define a superpotential and this is the frozen Jacobi algebra. If you don't know what it is, then this tells you explicitly what it is. Okay, and again, there's a central element called T. It acts as at any vertex as the boundary path of any adjacent faces at any adjacent face. And again, all these boundary paths are equal by the relations. So A is a Z order, as C was, and the point of the consistency condition says that somehow every corner of A, every EI, EJ, A, EI, which is just paths from I to J, modulo the relations, is a Z module of rank one. In particular, that means the projective modules are rank one at every vertex, and that's what we'll call rank one. That's what we mean by rank one. Okay, and then the third thing we want is the boundary algebra. Again, this came up in Karen's talk yesterday. We just look at the boundary idempotents and write B equals EAE for this boundary idempotent, and note that B actually is C in the uniform case for the full Grassmannian, but generally B is not C, but it actually has C naturally as a subalgebra. This is something we proved in this work I mentioned at the beginning, and the restriction from CMB to CMC is a fully faithful embedding. And so one thing Matthew proved in this context, that not quite CMB, which is the cluster category for the full Grassmannian, but GPB, so this is Gonstein projective B modules, that is, in this context, the Frobenius cluster category. It's contained in CMB, but it's usually smaller. it has a cluster tilting object, which is just EA, said abstractly. But what that means in practice is it's the boundary modules of the projectives, A modules. And also A is the endomorphism alpha of B, of T. And so using this, one of the things you can see is that a rank one module MJ is in this category. Basically, this theorem above tells you that CMB modules are special sorts of CMC modules. And here we say, well, what about the rank one guys? Well, they're the ones that are associated to the J in the positroid associated with the diamond model. So the positroid basically is B modules. And the proof, very quickly, is kind of in this context, we don't just have restriction to the boundary, but we have the adjoint to that, which is just on BTM. And from that, we see that every boundary module is the restriction of some A module here. And in fact, what we can show is that the rank one boundary modules are the restrictions of rank one A modules. So the question is, what are the rank one A modules? And the answer, because that's what the talk's about, is that they are given by perfect matching. So in effectively the same way as we had in the boundary, if we thought about it, every perfect matching on the diamond model gives a rank one module, which acts by T at the matched arrows and one at the other arrows. And all rank one modules have this form. And furthermore, the boundary module here, the restriction of this module to the boundary, which is now a rank one C module, well, can be thought of as a rank one C module. Strictly speaking, it's better than that, the rank one B module, but is this matching. So again, if this helps, these modules are rank one matrix factorizations of T on every face of this quiver. So basically the same phrase. And then, well, the natural question is, what are the projective matchings? So what are the boundary modules of the, and in particular, what are the boundary modules of the projective matchings, i.e. the sumands of this cluster tilting object that Matthew wrote down abstractly in this context? So as I said, consistency means that these modules are rank one, so they must be matching modules to some matching. And here's a way of saying what that matching is. It's the arrows, and here's an example. It's the arrows in the quiver that you don't need to use to get a minimal path. I don't know whether I can have time to draw this. So for example, if I start here, there's a minimal path to here. That doesn't pass through the tail. There's a minimal path to here. There's a minimal path to here. But if we want to come back, so now when we come back, we get to a point that we've already visited. So as always, the projectives are sort of start at the vertex you want and sort of flow downhill. And then here, the T's are what you have to do when you come back to somewhere you've already visited, basically. So the question is going to be, well, what are these? Well, it turns out that Muller-Spier wrote down, for combinatorial reasons, a canonical set of matchings, which are given by this sort of left, which are given by this downstream wedge argument. So I have an arrow. I have a point I there, and I look at any arrow A, and I draw the two strands that go through it, and I ask whether I is in the wedge. So the strands can't meet again by Poznikov's consistency conditions. So I just ask whether I is in this downstream wedge, the part here that is a bit greener in my slide than on the screen. Okay, and one of our key theorems in this paper, not the only one, but in some ways one that we've come to really like quite a lot, is that matching is the projective matching. And in particular, if you ask what this downstream wedge matching does at the boundary, it gives you the left source labeling that we saw before. So that means, in particular, that this cluster tilting object, T that Matt wrote down, is actually the direct sum of the rank one C modules given by the left source labeling of the equivalent. So that's what this thing is. And its endomorphism algebra is A. Its endomorphism algebra op is A. And B is the direct sum of the boundary labels. So B is the necklace. Well, strictly speaking, it's the projective B modules are the necklace. Not the projective C modules, but the projective B modules. And this is the thing whose rank one modules are the positroids. So in case you know and will remember that there's another necklace, of course, now it's obvious what the other necklace is. It's the injected B module. And we know how to distinguish the two necklaces because we know the difference between projectives and injectives. Okay, so that's the category. That's what one of the things that categorifying perfect matchings by modules tells you, that this funny combinatorics of Poznikov labeling. And in fact, if you go and actually look at the definition of the positroid from the necklace and think module theoretically, you can see that that definition is saying that the things in the positroid are P modules. So, I mean, that actually is essentially Poznikov's original definition of the positroid from the necklace. And then just to finish with a little tease, but I'll say two things. Firstly, how do we prove it? Well, we prove it rather less combinatorially than one might imagine could be possible by actually working out a projective resolution for every perfect matching module. And then working out that the what this amounts to in the case of the Müller-Speyer matchings is you sort of have to add up all these contributions and prove that what you get is just the projective. The class of the projective in the Grothendieck group. And then with a little bit more work, the point is the matching determines the module. So that means the matching module is the projective. And when we finally worked out what Müller-Speyer was saying about what Müller-Speyer did actually understand somehow this projective resolution combinatorially, then they sort of know this. But their proof is very indirect. So to sort of almost flip my original moral of the lecture, what we are missing is actually a nice direct combinatorial proof that these two matchings, one defined as using the downstream wedges and the other using the minimal path condition, are the same. And it looks extremely tempting. I mean, it's almost, you do an example and it's kind of clear that they're defining the same things. But I'm afraid we could never find a way of turning that into a proof. So that's a challenge for people who prefer combinatorics to representation. Okay, thank you very much.
Are there any questions? And perhaps we'll start with questions in the room, if there are any.
No questions in the room, it seems.
Shall I repeat the question? Bethany asks, can you hear me?
We can't hear you without that microphone.
So I guess this is all related to the cluster structure of these positroids.
Which cluster structure?
I'll add that to my question as well. Which cluster structure?
One of them. Yes. So, I mean, one of the things that this really highlights is that, I mean, so the crucial thing here is that the natural cluster category, or the apparently natural one in this case, namely GPB, isn't the whole of CMB. So there are potentially other cluster categories inside CMB that are equally good for providing a cluster structure on the positroid, and that really is what happened. So there's another one which you might call GIB, which essentially is the one generated by the injectives instead of the projective. One of the points is projectives and injectives are not the same. So there's one generated by the projectives, there's one that's kind of at the other end, generated by the injectives. I think Galash and Lam already defined two cluster structures, and those are the two they defined. And now Melissa and Chris and people are discovering lots more, which are basically other cluster categories which kind of sit between the projectives and the injectives in CMB and give other clusters. So this is very clarifying from the point of view of why does positroid have lots of cluster structures and the Grassmannian not?
Great, thank you.
So I think unless there's another quick question, there's a quick question in the chat. Greg Musiker is asking, does the twist map have a meaning in the categorification?
Yes, it's omega. It's the syzygy. Depending on which twist map you mean, it's basically the syzygy. It's basically the syzygy. Is that short enough answer?
He says thanks. So I think we probably ought to stop questions there. Will there be a riot in the actual room of the conference if we try to start again in 5 minutes?
No, that seemed to be the rule yesterday.
Okay, let's try to do that. That'll get us to maybe only 6 minutes behind, and we'll catch up gradually.
So, thanks very much.
Starting again at 13:51, and then Lara. Yes, let's thank our speaker again. Yes.